Welcome to the Free Cities Podcast. My name is Timothy Allen, and this is the official podcast of the Free Cities Foundation. Welcome to episode number 8 of the Free Cities Podcast. Now, if you like what you've been hearing up until this point, I would like to ask you to please subscribe to us via your preferred podcasting app. And if you have the time to leave a review, that would also be greatly appreciated. Today, I'm talking with Sean Pawley, the founder and CEO of Seshat Bank, which is the full-service commercial bank currently establishing itself in the Free City project of Prospera in Honduras. Now, this conversation was recorded before I spoke with Sean's colleague, Christian Betancourt, which you can hear in episode number 3. So I entered this conversation knowing absolutely nothing about the ins and outs of starting a bank. So you may have to forgive me a little for my rather naive lines of questioning. However, the conversation quickly moves on, and we end up covering an extremely diverse set of topics, including neo-medievalism, artificial intelligence, how to fund a war in pre-revolutionary France, and the pros and cons of differing governance models in space. I bet you weren't expecting that from the guy at the bank. Anyway, I hope you enjoy this chat. I certainly did. So it just leaves for me to say to you, please sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Sean Pawley. Okay, right, before we get into, just introduce yourself your name is and what you're doing currently.
So I am Sean Pawley. I'm the founder of Seshat Bank. We are an API-first full-service commercial bank. The core idea is that we provide API access to all of our customers, enabling them to build applications directly on top of bank payment rails. Eventually, we're going to have an app store and really allow every single one of our commercial customers to have a fully unique and customizable bank account that is unique to their business's needs. Right now, every single business gets exactly the same services from their bank. A pizza restaurant and the largest real estate developer in, you know, whatever country, if you look at their phones, they have the exact same bank accounts. You know, one has a bit more money in it than the other, but other than that, they are exactly the same. Now, pizza places have very, very, very different needs than a real estate developer does, and their bank account should reflect those different needs. It should reflect, you know, the cash flow analysis needs of that business. It should reflect all of the various things regarding inventory and supply chain management. It should reflect basically the business's needs as a whole, not just, you know, how much money do I have today.
Firstly, how does your business that you're currently in now relate to Prospera? Why is there a relationship between yourself and Prospera?
So Seshat Bank originally was not actually going to be incorporated within Prospera. We were originally looking at Uganda and Rwanda as a starting point. We were going to get an MFI banking license over there. But as I'm sure the listeners may be aware, getting banks up and running is very, very, very difficult from a legal point of view. And with Prospera itself, we were actually able to craft the legal environment that our bank specifically needed and wanted. And we were able to basically just dramatically simplify the actual licensing process, get rid of a lot of the cruft and a lot of the excess that is in the that is in most other countries' systems, and basically get down to the core of what, you know, bank regulation really needs to be from a risk management and from a liability point of view.
And so how did you hear about Prospera? Was that, when you're looking for a place to start a bank, do things like this just come up on your radar, or how does it work?
No. So I've been in the charter city space for probably 5-6 years now. I've known Mark Letter since the beginning of the Charter Cities Institute, way back when it had a different name. So I've been aware of Prospera for quite some time. But it was just in April of this past year when I gave a call to the chief of staff over at Prospera and basically said, you know, listen, Prospera has made some great progress recently, but I'd like to, you know, basically see whether or not my bank would actually be possible within Prospera. Give him a quick overview. It is turned out it was very possible, the vision that I had. And then spoke with several businesses here in Honduras, got a very quick feel for whether or not there would be demand for our services. There was, made the switch and, you know, closed the seed round in September of last year. And right now here we are, literally any day about to go live.
I'm going to sound a bit stupid here, I think. I know nothing about starting a bank. My experience of banks is probably high street banks. I'm assuming that what you're offering is something completely different to that. How do you go about starting a bank, and what are the major hurdles that you come up against normally?
Mm-hmm. So, well, usually you only start one, so you don't really get a whole lot of practice at it. So when you're talking about starting a bank itself, usually there are a couple different requirements. So the first is capital requirements. Here in Prospera, we have a $10 million equity or long-term capital requirement. And that's, you know, fairly, that's not really too high. It's a fairly manageable figure. Within Honduras itself, it's about 20 million, El Salvador, 20 million, Colombia, 9 million. You know, it varies country by country, but, there's always some degree of capital requirements, that are put in place by the legislature and by the country's banking regulators. And that basically is there is first loss capital. So essentially if the bank is losing money, any losses come out of equity. They do not come out of the deposits that, you know, people put into that people put into the bank. The shareholders are the ones who are actually at risk. So secondly, after that, then there are various reviews of basically the management and director CVs. There's a basically the regulators look over the business plan fairly extensively. They look at how much capital you have on hand. They look at your managerial experience, they look at all kinds of different things basically, and then make the determination as to whether or not they think that the bank would be feasible. And then at that point, then they can issue a banking license. But banking regulators also have various other things, such as in many countries, they can demand on-the-spot audits of bank financial records, which can be somewhat time intensive and distract the staff from other things that they might be doing. There are a number of different things from a regulatory point of view that we've basically simplified here, that just allow us to operate in a leaner, quicker fashion.
And are you specifically providing banking services to Honduras, or is it
no?
So it doesn't matter where you start your bank; you go to the place where the regulatory appetite is best for you, let's say, whatever.
Well, I mean, so from a bank, basically a bank in London can service a U.S. citizen that's not in London. A bank in Germany can service someone in China who's never been to Germany. So banks can service anyone anywhere on the planet, period. That's, you know, just how it is. What a bank license does is it gives you access to the local payment system. It signifies basically that you have met a certain standard as far as risk management, as far as basically the management quality of your standard of your bank is, and it allows you to advertise within that jurisdiction. So that's what a bank license really signifies. It signifies certain degree of managerial competence and, you know, risk capital available to protect depositors. Gives you access to the local payment system and lets you advertise, and that's really all that it does. So here in Prospera, what our bank license mostly does is it mostly signifies basically the competence and the risk management point of view.
And from talking to other people at Prospera here, I get this sense that the regulatory the regulations are based upon regulations of other particular jurisdictions that they consider are already correct, or I don't know how you'd say that. So what did you use as your sort of reference point for regulations then?
So bank regulation, generally speaking, can be split into three different parts. So the first is going to be KYC AML, which is every bank everywhere on the planet has to follow this. This is basically standards as far as when banks have to report suspicious transactions, things of that nature. So for us, we follow U.S. standards that were established in the Bank Secrecy Act. Secondly is risk management. And this is where, you know, it actually varies significantly country to country. So for us, we moved away from the traditional Basel system, and we actually moved more towards a system that was proposed by Mervyn King, the former governor of the Bank of England during the financial crisis. And what we did was we adopted a lot of his points of view, and we adopted a lot of his ideas towards moving risk around and towards minimizing risk to current depositors. And in the end, what I think is that I think we are able to have a bank with a leaner capital structure that has the same level of risk as, you know, a bank in the United States or a bank in Europe or, you know, bank anywhere else in the world, essentially. But the key thing with Mervyn King's regulatory framework is having the third party lender, or, you know, in his case, the central bank, that is there to assess the riskiness of the individual assets and is available to essentially set up a line of credit against those assets and is able to provide cash to the bank at any point in time. So we have a third party lender, you know, a large international financial institution that is able to lend at any point in time against our assets. And at any point in time, we have to have basically a line of credit that is greater than the value of our current liabilities.
If you'd have gone ahead in another country, what would the difference have been in your customer base, for example, if anything? Like, would it have made a difference?
It would have. I mean, if we were originally in Rwanda and Uganda, I don't think we would have had anywhere near the level of interest that we have from U.S. persons right now, which, you know, U.S. persons also carries its own degree of regulatory compliance, since we need to be FATCA compliant and all of that. But, you know, I think over in Rwanda and Uganda, I think we would have mostly just been working with local companies there. I think there would have been substantially less interest in the actual programmability aspect of the bank. But here in Honduras, you know, we're very close to the U.S. It's a fairly well-established market, lots of ties to the U.S., fairly good developer ecosystem here and within Latin America more broadly. So I think we're able to get a much better international base here than we would have elsewhere.
And I'm trying to think of the process you go through. Say, for example, you know, you were going to set up in Africa before you decided here. What do you do about things like staff? Are you looking locally for that kind of talent? And are you bringing everyone in? You're saying, right, we're all going to move to this country and we're all going to do this thing. You know, you're like, when you're sitting around dreaming up a project like this, are you thinking, okay, you know, our options are A, B, and C, but when we choose one, we've got to just bring everyone in and just plant them there and start from scratch? Is it?
Not really. So for us, most of our staff is actually located in Poland, Nigeria, India. We don't really have too much as far as staff goes within Honduras itself. Within Honduras, it's mostly our legal and finance teams, just because those are the teams that really need to actually be present here. Legal team for compliance purposes, and the finance team, just because any loans that we issue basically is very, very good for the finance team to all be in one single place just to communicate with each other, share ideas, and, you know, do all of that. So basically, legal and finance are located here. Everyone else, we don't really care where you are, you know, as long as you're going to come here, work hard, and do solid work, we don't really care where.
And I take it you have one of the spaces up at Prospera over there for those people, the legal team and et cetera.
That's correct, yeah. Yeah, so we've got an office over there.
So, okay, going back to my original, when we were talking right at the start, this part of Prospera, from what I understand, was already here. It was bought as is. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit, if you know it, about the history of this as opposed to the Prospera that we've just come from earlier, which is basically a section of jungle until they decided to build what they've built there?
Mm-hmm. So this area was, you know, built as a resort community, and I'm not actually sure when they started construction on it, but the original developer fell into a bit of disrepute and left the country, didn't actually finish construction of the project. And so, you know, things started falling apart here a few years ago. And then Prospera came in, Prospera bought up half the project itself, poured a ton of money, a ton of resources into it, cleaned everything up, and just, you know, drove a lot of investment in this space. So now this area is basically, it's completely rejuvenated. Property sales are going through at a fairly high rate. You know, the restaurants are renovated and they've got brand new menus, new kitchens. You know, people are always going to them. Tons of stuff going on.
Do you happen to know what percentage of people that are living around here, or even anecdotally from your experience are kind of working here? How many people are holidaying here? How many people are...
I have no idea.
No, right.
None whatsoever.
How long have you been here out of interest?
Close to a year now.
And do you travel up to the place, what's it called? The Prospero we've just been... Mm-hmm. What's that building called?
The Beta Building.
The Beta Building, that's right, yeah.
Yeah.
Is that something you need to do much?
Yeah. So I travel up there fairly often. But I mean, I travel everywhere very often. I'm here, I'm in the US, I'm everywhere.
So you mentioned that you've been into or following the progress of sort of CETES for 6 years or 5 years, or just the concept
charter cities
of charter
in general.
Cities, yeah.
Yeah.
Is that something, what brought you to have an interest in those kind of places?
So I have a maize mill in Uganda that I still have about 60% of. Just my experience with that and my experience with the Ugandan legal regime and generally speaking the regulatory framework over there left me desiring a somewhat better experience as far as government services and regulations go. And charter cities and special economic zones in general are a great way of actually going about and implementing these new systems in a way that, you know, respects national sovereignty, in a way that keeps everyone happy. And, you know, it's just a very smooth way of actually improving the general regulatory and business environment.
Do you have any particular kind of ideological interest in what a lot of these places might represent in the future? Is that something you think about, or is it just there's an opportunity there? So, you know.
I have a substantial amount of ideological interest, but the reason why I'm here fundamentally just boils down to, you know, the business.
So have you got an idea of what the future holds for places like this? Is it something, do you ever travel down that timeline in your mind and think in 50, 75 years, is this something you've consider has longevity?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I think the charter cities in general have pretty substantial longevity. Special economic zones, charter cities are, I guess you would actually say, more of a traditional way of governing. A lot of the modern centralized states are basically a historic aberration. The norm historically is for a lot of local rule, local control, and charter cities are essentially a way moving back towards that kind of regime. So I think that they absolutely have a lot of staying power. You know, it's a return to the norm. I don't, you know, particularly think 50, 70 years out. I don't really think, I don't think anything on that kind of time frame. Just, you know, who knows what the world will be like in that time, in that time frame. Like, I don't think if I was living in the 1970s, it would be very productive to think about the year 2020. But no, I like to think that it's a return to the historic norm. I think that in general, the concept has, it's got a lot of runway.
And possibly, especially at this time, I mean, the, you know, the political situations around the world are leading towards, let's say, it's maybe a renaissance and things like this. I don't know whether that's something you would agree with.
Yeah. Yeah. So I would agree with that. I mean, I would say that my general view towards the immediate future has been very heavily influenced by Martin Gurry's work, Revolt of the Public. It's been very influenced by a concept called neo-medievalism as well. And basically, I mean, when you take a look at those two things and changes in communication technology, changes in, primarily communications technology, basically what you see is increasing instability at the central government level. And if you're looking for a stable business environment, the area that you really want to focus on is, you know, get a stable local government and just, you know, invest heavily in that area. And that's, I think that you're going to see a lot of decentralization of power over the next 20 years, you know, across the board in many, many, many countries.
Two things there. Decentralization of power, I agree. I hope. Obviously, I don't know how many governments are interested in decentralization of power. Is that, you know, how does decentralization of power manifest itself when you have a top-down government, for example?
Well, it doesn't always manifest itself in a very good way. So basically, there are, you know, a couple of different ways the power can decentralize. So the first would be a positive way, such as, you know, special economic zones, charter cities, where basically the government's say, you know, local governments can have significantly more autonomy with regards to commercial law, things of that nature, and basically give these local governments the kind of control that they need to actually manage their area and govern their area appropriately. The other way is basically, you know, you can see quite a bit of it in the Middle East. You can actually see quite a bit of it in Mexico as well, where power is decentralized to a significant degree, and there are various groups that can credibly contest the central government. So, you know, in Syria, for instance, you had several groups that were credibly contesting the central government there for quite some time. I don't really view that as a very positive decentralization power. I don't think that anyone would want to live in that kind of world, where you have multiple Islamist groups in, you know, pitched gunfights against the government. That's also decentralization, but very, very negative. And I think everyone should want to avoid that. And likewise in Mexico, you know, there's the cartels and all of that. But I personally think that basically as far as decentralization of power goes, you know, give power to local governments, let them have more control over commercial regulation, let them experiment more, let them do all of that. And that's a very positive future. There's going to be a lot more innovation. There's going to be a lot more investment. And there's going to be, you know, a lot more broad social stability.
Do you think that kind of idea is seductive enough to a government? Because I mean you could see it as a Trojan horse, couldn't you? You could see it as on one hand, yes, they're going to benefit, you would hope, but on the other hand, decentralization inherently decentralizes top-down power.
Yeah, so decentralization does inherently take away power from the people who currently have it and gives it to other people. Basically, you know, I don't really know that a lot of them find it very attractive just because it takes away what they have and gives it to other people. But we have many, many historic examples of rulers making these kinds of decisions and giving away power to local governments. The Holy Roman Empire actually has numerous, numerous examples of this. And I would always recommend reading, there's a book called The Heart of Europe, which is about the constitution and history of the Holy Roman Empire, from, you know, 800 to 1800 AD. There's, you know, the entirety of the Baltic Sea, in Europe is another great example of it. There's many, many, American tribal federations, pre-Columbus. There's, also, if you're looking at several of the pre-colonial African societies, there are many, many examples of this. And I would also say late Ming Dynasty China is also another fairly good example of this too.
Is that a societal ebb and flow then? Centralized to decentralized to centralized? Is it?
I don't know that it's an ebb and flow, but basically the nature.
It's like a pendulum swing.
I don't know about a pendulum. I don't really think it works quite like that. It's more that the nature and structure of a given government depends largely on two things, and that's communication technology and military technology. And those can be either centralizing or decentralizing. And right now, you know, there's a lot of things that are very centralizing about the internet and about current defensive tech, and there are a lot of things that are very decentralizing. So, you know, on the centralizing side, you're looking at if you have, you know, a given area that you want to defend against some outside power, you need to buy a lot of very expensive hardware. It costs a lot of money to buy an F-16, which who can afford that? So basically that's a big centralizing force. You need a lot of people to pay for that kind of defensive tech. On the other hand, there's also, you know, 3D printed guns. So if someone said, well, I don't really want to, or if enough people said that, there's, you know, no gun control can't really do anything about it. And likewise, on the communications technology side, there's AI has basically given central governments the ability to monitor and look at communications to a degree that previously would have been absolutely impossible. But the internet itself and a lot of modern cryptographic techniques have also given people the ability to keep their communications secret from government, from criminals, from, you know, basically any kind of third party. So there's always a mix of both at any point in time. And, you know, there's no real guarantee which way the pendulum is going to swing. It just goes.
You sound like you know a lot about this. So in your opinion, would you say that the decentralized versus centralized, in my words, the pendulum, it strikes me that it's currently, certainly, it appears to be far more centralized on the centralized side, but also historically. Am I wrong there?
It's fairly centralized now, but it could be substantially more centralized. You know, in the 1990s, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, there was obviously massive decentralization of power in Eastern Europe. And I would also actually say within, you know, most of Western Europe, within the United States as well, there was a massive wave of privatization across Europe, across the Americas. In general, you know, government shrank across the board. There was a big, big, big wave of decentralization. And, you know, governments now are still nowhere near as centralized as they were during the Cold War era. It's considerably more decentralized. So, you know, it's relatively high compared to the historic norm. But
I mean, what about the, you know, going hundreds of years back then? It strikes me that historically, as in that time frame, certainly I've heard far more about centralized powers than I've heard about decentralized powers. Is that fair, or am I a bad historian?
I would say it's substantially more centralized now than it was in, say, you know, 1800. But just to give you an idea, so in the you know, the old regime in France, pre-revolution, the French monarchy was incredibly, incredibly, incredibly decentralized. While the king himself had absolute authority, theoretically, every single department of the country had their own measurement system for, you know, weights, for inches, for all of that. And so if the king, and there's a great book as well that I'll recommend to everyone called, Seeing Like a State. I'll recommend that to everyone. You know, let's say you're the king of France and you want to raise taxes to pay for a war or something like that. The best way to raise taxes, well, pretty much the only thing your country produces is grain. So you can say, okay, I want every family in France to give me 1 pint of grain. Well, the problem is each department has a different measure for what a pint is. So you can't say that because every single department is going to send in a different measure. Some are going to pay more, some are going to pay less. So you can say, okay, you know, we're going to have a bunch of people in Paris. They're going to make baskets that are 1 pint, and they're going to send these out to all of the departments, and you need to fill up this basket with grain, and, you know, that's going to be your taxes. Well, what happens when it gets wet? And literally all of these things are things that the Kingdom of France did just to try and standardize taxes across the kingdom. So they send out the baskets. What happens if some of them get wet? They stretch more, and then a family will need to put more grain in. So, you know, you'll have riots. People will be upset. Then you say, okay, well, each village has a church. So let's carve into the church steps 1 pint, and you need to fill up this, you know, stone crevice with grain. Well, the height that you pour it in from matters as well. So there are a lot of these different things, basically. But power itself was decentralized in the Kingdom of France, largely because, you know, the king himself, while he had theoretically absolute control over anything and he could pass any law he wanted to, realistically, he couldn't actually do that much without the consent and without the approval of local authorities.
I don't want to move on before I've asked you about neo-medievalism, but before I do, on that point, do you have a particular time, historical time, moment, country that you would consider was a model decentralized place?
No.
The best one, or the most efficient, or the one that appeals most to you?
The one that appeals most would probably be the U.S. circa 1900. But even that, there are a lot of things, you know, that I prefer about the modern era, like penicillin. I wouldn't really want to go back to that time period.
All right, just on the governance side of it then.
On the governance side, I mean, even on that side, so power was considerably more decentralized back then, but there were also a number of things that I think were pretty, there were a lot of issues with government back then, from, you know, basically private militias essentially, you know, going on murdering union members. You know, there were a lot of nasty things that were going on back then that I don't really think were all that desirable and that I'm pretty glad we got rid of over time. You know, I would say that US circa 1900 is probably the closest, but there are a lot of drawbacks to that time frame as well.
Describe then your version in the current age then. We're in 2022 and you can, you know, what would your governance model be?
Honestly, I really like the ZA model itself. I think that works very, very, very well. I really, really like the Prospera regulatory model and social setup. I would say that as far as model governance goes, Liechtenstein also seems to be very, very good. But I'm not sure how much of that is just due to the fact that they happen to have a good monarch. But there are, I'm also not particularly fond of the whole monarchy system. But Liechtenstein has a lot of other things going for it too. Switzerland, probably. There are a lot of things that I do like about Switzerland. I'm not too fond of how restrictive they are with regards to immigration. I don't really like that. Everything is, you know, up to a vote directly by the people. Singapore is very good on as far as quality of life goes, but the government there itself is, can be authoritarian in, you know, a number of different ways. So I don't really know if there's any place I would really like in the current year.
All right, then you mentioned the ZAs and seem to be quite near the top of your list. So what are the strongest points and the strongest attributes of the ZA system?
Basically, complete autonomy with regards to commercial law itself. They have to follow the criminal law of Honduras, but the criminal law is largely things that, you know, no one objects to. You can't rob, you can't murder, you can't do anything like that. Well, that's easy. I don't plan to. So the commercial law, it just gives a lot more authority to the local government as far as developing a commercial code that really matches what businesses need to develop and what businesses need to actually invest in these countries. And that kind of flexibility is really, really vital, just as far as driving investment, as far as, you know, creating a positive environment for businesses goes.
Okay. On the flip side, then, what are the hurdles that you've noticed having dipped your toes into the ZA world, let's say?
From the ZAs or from others?
From the ZAs to begin with.
I really haven't had any issues from the ZAs themselves. Most of the issues that I've come across have just been because we're, a new bank operating within a special economic zone. So it takes a while. Basically, within the banking space, everyone is very cautious. Everyone is very slow. So it just takes a while for, you know, everyone to get used to us and to become comfortable with us and with the AML enforcement regime here.
Are you the only bank that's ever set up in a ZA?
There are multiple banks that have set up in special economic zones around the world. We are the only bank that is currently in a ZA specifically.
Do you know the other banks? Are you sort of like...
in other special economic zones? Or?
Yeah. Do you know the guys that run them and do you know...
I do not know the CEO of HSBC. No.
Oh, right. I thought... So, but what about a recently started one then?
I mean, even then, I don't really know. There's a bunch of banks that have set up in the DIFC, Hong Kong, Shanghai, Singapore, the various... There are various free zones in Nigeria that actually provide for banking laws as well, or that actually provide for the establishment of banks there too.
I suppose what I'm getting at is, is anyone looking at what you're doing and going, it looks pretty good over there. He's getting it right, or the regulations are good, or whatever, compared to similar projects in other parts of the world.
There are, yeah, but I'm not going to mention them.
Okay. All right. Well, that's a good segue into going back to the word neo-medievalism. Can you just explain what neo-medievalism is? This sounds like a complete backtrack, but I want to know what that means.
Yeah, sure. So, I guess let's start off and actually establish medievalism itself. So when you think about the medieval era and governance within the medieval era, can you tell me, you know, a little bit what you think, what you know about that?
I'm going to guess that it's feudalism.
Not necessarily. Feudalism never really existed.
Okay, well, there were large houses, which served as the courthouse and also the gentry's house.
Yep.
And around them, there were people that paid tithes or paid, you know, a percentage of what they produced to that central power.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's one way of looking at it. But it's basically there's the king, there's the nobles, and the nobles were effectively just large landowners who essentially parlayed their land ownership into participation in the government. And they were able to do so because basically being a landlord typically contracts with the people who are renting the land, the serfs, included being entitled to call them up for military service, things of that nature. So due to the, I'll call it mixed, you know, civil-military nature of that society, nobles were able to get roles in government itself, either in, you know, some kind of legislative sense, judicial sense, various ways. But the key thing about the medieval era, and this is really what goes into neo-medievalism, is that the king himself, while he may have theoretically absolute authority, ultimately relied on various different power groups within the kingdom to maintain his authority. So he relied on the support of the church. If the church withdrew the support from the king, he would not be king for very much longer. As you know, we saw when the Holy Roman Emperor was excommunicated by the Pope, there were multiple rebellions within the Holy Roman Empire itself to overthrow and get rid of him. Likewise, if he did something that the nobility didn't like, he tried to raise taxes, he tried to do whatever, something the nobility didn't like, they would rebel and they would, you know, force some kind of settlement, as we saw in England with the Magna Carta. But basically, it's neo-medievalism itself is essentially the rise of various groups that can credibly contest the center. And this is not necessarily a positive thing, as mentioned before. There are many, many, many negative examples that I can think of where I think you would be much happier living under a centralized regime than under a country that is currently undergoing this.
Sorry, but what are the neo groups that...
Well, this is the aforementioned, you know, the negative examples of decentralization of power. You know, you look at Syria and the civil war going on there. Absolutely. You look at Mexico with the cartels. You look at all of these various groups. You have various groups that are able to credibly contest the authority of the center in order to maintain their own ability to act. And that's not necessarily a positive thing. But I think that basically with current communications technology and with, you know, some recent advancements in, you know, the military side of things, it increasingly looks like we're moving towards that. But there are a lot of ways for the transition to go very, very, very poorly. And that's something that I hope people think about. You know, how do we actually decentralize authority and do so peacefully and do so in a way that, you know, makes sense for everyone, makes everyone happy. You know, if you're left wing and you want a government that's far, far, far more involved in economic affairs, okay, how do we make sure that you stay happy? How do we, you know, you have your own little area where you can actually run your society that way, versus the people like me who don't really want that. We can have our own little place, basically decentralize, let everyone self-sort, let everyone move into these areas, as opposed to having, you know, effectively very, very violent gangs or terrorist groups that are, you know, have some, or, you know, in the Middle East, it's authoritarian groups, and Mexico, it's just groups that want to keep selling drugs and, you know, don't want to follow the law.
How do you mitigate the rise of that side of decentralization then? You know, like take Honduras as an example. If you follow this model into the future and more ZAs appear, decentralized, giving people the chance to vote with their own money and say, okay, well, I'm going to go to this one, I'm going to live here. And how do you not have the rise of, say, you know, groups that challenge through force rather than through abstract force, let's say, you know, like of the government, but real force? How does that work?
I mean, with the ZAs themselves, very, very easy, since the ZAs don't have weapons. You know, the national police can come in at any time. If someone's committing a crime, they come in and arrest. They, you know, so like with the ZAs themselves, it's decentralization of authority in a way that, you know, makes everyone happy from a commercial point of view, which is really what ultimately a lot of people care about. I think on the criminal side, people mostly agree about these things. People mostly argue about the cultural and commercial side of things. And I think that's really where the focus on as far as decentralization should go. But, you know, like, again, using Honduras as an example, the centralization of criminal enforcement, I don't think anyone really cares too much about that, just because no one really cares if the central government is enforcing laws against murder versus a local government. Everyone objects to it. Everyone wants it gone. You know, no one really cares who is actually performing it. Whereas commercial laws, there's a lot more variability of opinion.
On the former, though, who does it better in your eyes? Centralized power or decentralized power?
I don't really think that there's a good answer to that, mostly because it varies quite a bit. You know, within the United States, for instance, criminal enforcement is largely handled at the local and state level. And there are some states that do criminal enforcement very, very well. So New Hampshire, for instance, has very, very, very low crime rates, very, very few murders. Whenever there is a murder, you know, the police generally find the guy who did it fairly quickly. Whenever there's a rape or a robbery, you know, the police are fairly good about investigating and determining who did it. And then you look at a city like Chicago or Baltimore, where the police are completely overwhelmed by the amount of violence that's within those cities, and they just don't do a very good job. And you know, they would probably benefit from, you know, someone like the FBI stepping in and assisting, or, you know, taking over a good portion of the investigations. So I don't really think that centralized versus decentralized really matters all that well in that case. There's also a lot of benefits to centralization when it comes to fighting crime. Just, you know, if, again, using the U.S. as an example, someone commits a murder in New Hampshire and then goes down to Arizona. Well, in some decentralized society, there's no guarantee that the police in New Hampshire and Arizona are going to be communicating with each other and can actually, you know, handle the investigation appropriately. So it makes sense just to have, you know, the FBI or some kind of central authority there to coordinate, communicate, and basically assist in the extradition from Arizona to New Hampshire.
So your decision to come here, other than obviously to start your bank here, how much of that, now that you're living here and you're part of, you know, life here, is that make you content that you're in a place where you feel like you're kind of getting the governance model that you want, regardless of whether you can start your business here or not, you know?
I mean, I'm mostly here for the bank, but no, it's a nice little perk that, you know, I'm able to be here in a place where I feel like it matches the kind of governance style that I think would be very appropriate.
Like I say, maybe I'm the only one that thinks like this, but I do think into the future. Whenever I'm looking at a place like this, I'm imagining, okay, where does this go? Because, you know, I would like, if I was positioning myself in a place like this, I'd want to know what I thought the future might hold for it. Do you have a view of, from your ideological perspective, do you see a longevity to what's going on here, and something that would make you stay on account of that, not just the fact that your business is here?
No, I mean, I usually move around just for my business itself. I don't really stay in a place for ideological reasons. I know people who do move for ideological reasons. There's, you know, the Free State Project in the U.S. There's, back in the 1960s, there was a big movement of left-wing people to the state of Vermont. So, you know, I know that there are a lot of people who do move to places for ideological reasons, but I'm not one of them.
Or even just, you know, most people just often want to be left alone often, if they're not being left alone. I mean, I would say certainly in the last 2 years, a lot of people have moved on account of ideological reasons. I know a lot of them, especially Canadians, living now in El Salvador, Mexico, various places. So it's happening a lot more, and it's mostly people rubbing up against authoritarian policies, let's say, in their own country. Presumably for you, that would be a reason to move around, having the rights, being, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I kind of get the sense here that part of the appeal of a place is that you're allowed to, you know, get on with doing what you want to do. And if you're a good person, there's a good thing there. You shouldn't really be, you know, scrutinized as much as we are in many jurisdictions around the world. So, you know, you would move on account of that. That's a strategy for, you know.
I don't know that I would move for that, but, you know, it all plays a role in my decision making.
Can I ask you a simple question for you with regards to Prospera? What do you personally think Prospera is? Because I've asked some other people, I've got differing answers. I know it's a place, but it's also more than that. Do you have a, if someone said to you, what is, if I asked you what is Prospera, what would your answer be?
Special economic zone.
Just that?
Yep.
Okay. And what are the main characteristics of this particular specialist sete, a specialist economic zone, which makes it different to any other special economic zone?
So most special economic zones globally, their primary reason for existing is they just give tax incentives to businesses. So if you have, say, a company that's exporting a lot of products, you'll get various, you know, no income tax, no tariffs, no anything like that. Basically, as long as some percentage of the product that you manufacture is exported, but they don't really give you too much as far as regulatory flexibility. And I really think that the regulatory flexibility, the speed at which Prospera can operate as far as giving you permits to, you know, set up construction, to basically, you know, actually run your business, I think that that's just a massive, massive, massive advantage. The regulatory side of things is the big, big focus area for me. And I think that that's really where most people and most businesses would actually find a big advantage here over the traditional SEZ.
How much of your own particular banking regulation did you get to author yourself, let's say?
Well, myself, I personally did not author very much, but our legal team authored quite a bit. I would say they authored probably close to half of it.
And how does that compare to other places?
In most other places, we would author none of it. So it's a considerable step up.
Do you expect other banks to begin here in the same way?
I do. You know, we're the first one. I don't think that we're going to be the last. My expectation is that we certainly will not be the last. I expect other banks to move in here, you know, relatively soon. But yeah, for the moment, we're the only one. I'm pretty happy being the only one. No objections to it. I'm not going to complain about lack of competition.
What about your opinion of Prospera, the place itself? How do you see that in the future? Do you see the, let's say the residential side of it, do you see that evolving?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So on the residential side itself, I think that, there are a lot of benefits to living in Prospera itself, as opposed to living under the ordinary regime. From just a tax point of view, from a simplicity of life point of view, from, you know, number of different benefits. But, you know, here in Roatan specifically, there's a massive, massive housing shortage. And within the ZA itself, developers are actually able to build the housing necessary for people. So Prospera ZA already has the tallest building in Roatan. And I'm working with a developer to ensure that there is substantially more construction, so that, you know, within the next few years, we'll begin to seriously alleviate the housing shortage in Roatan, and ideally get a lot more people moving to Roatan itself, you know, getting a proper city set up here on the island.
Do you know have any data, even anecdotes, of people coming back on account of what's going on here regarding the cities, or other than like actual Hondurans themselves?
Well, it's still early days. I think most of it is not so much people coming back, but it's more people not going. So there are a lot of people within the ZA project that are very skilled, that have, you know, a lot of skills that would be very useful within the United States, and that could fairly easily get jobs in the U.S. that pay much better than any job that they could get here. But they remained with the ZA just because, from, you know, both a cost of living point of view, as well as a, you know, stay at home, build a country, don't have to live too far from your family. I think that's more what's happened so far. But I think that as the ZA itself develops, and particularly as the Las Ceiba site grows, I think that you're going to see a lot more people coming back from the U.S. and working in and starting up new companies, starting new factories, doing all of that within the ZA.
How does it work with yourself? Presumably you're an American citizen, right? Mm-hmm. Is that a simple process when you come to a ZA to get, you know, to be allowed to stay for however long you need to stay?
Yeah, I mean, so the ZAs don't have any authority over immigration. That's National government has that.
Right, so you just apply the same way that anyone would?
Yeah, same way anyone else does. You know, we work with some lawyers, and they send in the application, and periodically I go in and, you know, get a visa renewal.
And do you, I'm going back to that long-term thing again, do you anticipate going back to America, or do you anticipate?
Probably at some point.
Do you ever think that something along these lines would evolve in the US?
I do. I don't think it would evolve in a state itself. I think it would be much more likely in a territory than it would be in a state. So just to give you an example, and this is one that, you know, I've thought about, but I don't have anywhere near the connections to actually get something like this going. But the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base itself. So that is under the control and authority of the Secretary of the Navy. But the base itself basically only occupies one side of the harbor, but it has control over both sides. You could just build a city on the other side, and then you can have, you know, all kinds of Cubans who want to make more money, get higher wages. They move in there. You can just say, listen, within the zone you're operating under, you know, the UCC, standard U.S. commercial code, significantly better than the Cuban regulatory regime. And, you know, if you're there, there's already a lot of demand because whatever business you set up can service the naval base too. And there's a whole bunch of different things. But I think, you know, if you set something like that up in the US, I think that something like that would probably be the most likely place just because it's dramatically simpler from a legal point of view than it would be setting something up in, say, Florida or, you know, California or someplace like that. The other thing as well would be the US tribes have effectively state level sovereignty. So you might see something in the future with some of the tribes. You would still have to obey federal law, but you would be able to operate in the United States with considerably more freedom than you would under your typical local or state law.
It just occurred to me, actually, the Amish communities and things like that, do they have any similarities with...
Some. So the Amish themselves have some degree of autonomy. So technically, you know, all laws and regulations of the United States apply to the Amish community, but they kind of stay to themselves. So, you know, it's no one really bothers with them. There are two things that I can think of that do not apply to the Amish community. So the first is Social Security. The Amish do not pay into Social Security. They cannot withdraw from Social Security. So none of their taxes go towards that. And the reason for that is they have basically a tradition of providing for the elders in their community. And as a result, they do not have to pay into Social Security. And the other one would be military draft. So the Amish themselves, if they are drafted, they just go into they can work as a nurse in a hospital. They can do truck driving. They can do peaceful things associated with that, but they would not actually be subject to military itself. But those are really the only two things. Everything else, you know, legally applies to them.
I'm interested to know whether you... I think I kind of already asked this before, but I don't feel satisfied yet in knowing what you're thinking. But what do you see as the best model going forward? Or do you just believe, okay, that doesn't matter. Everyone has their own model, and we hope they all implement alongside each other in parallel.
No, I don't want things implemented in parallel. No, what I want is experimentation. I don't think that anyone has discovered some kind of optimal method of governing a specific area. I don't think anyone's found that yet. So what I want is, you know, let 1,000 flowers bloom. Let a lot of experiments happen. Let all of these things occur. That way we can actually experiment. We can find out what works, what doesn't work, all of that. Now, I think that the Prospera experiment will work. I think it's going to work out very, very well. But I want 1,000 other experiments doing different things. I don't want just Prospera. I want a ton of different experiments in governance themselves. Just to, you know, determine what actually makes people happy, what actually is going to drive the best quality of life. You know, I think Prospera is good for me, but I think that a lot of other people would be fairly unhappy with it. So, you know, it's not one size fits all.
I've got one question that we ask everyone on these podcasts. I'm not sure how it relates to you necessarily, but I'll ask you anyway. You have a one-year sabbatical during which all your expenses are covered by a patron of yours, and you can do anything you want in that year. You can pursue anything you want. What do you do?
Build Calperna 1.
What's that?
It's an orbital space station, and since all my expenses are covered, I've got basically unlimited budget to do whatever I want to. So I want that to be built within a year.
Is that possible?
I don't know, within a year, but you know,
you've got a year.
A year might be pushing it a little bit. But since I've got unlimited money, I think I can push things forward a little bit more aggressively than would normally be possible.
Why in particular that? What is it about that?
So space habitation itself, I have been fascinated by that for a long, long time. I think that there are a lot of benefits just to leaving Earth and living up there. But Calpurnia 1 specifically, I think, is very, very nice just because it's basically the smallest viable station at 1G. So it has 1G spin gravity. And it's the smallest viable station that's not going to induce nausea with the spin.
Sorry, I don't know anything about this. Is it already, it's been designed, it just hasn't been built, or it's in the...
Rough sketches have been designed. Right. There's a lot of work that needs to get from, you know, where we are today to an actual finished design for it. I'll say the rough sketches have been made for it.
So what's your interest in dwelling in space then?
I think that once you actually reach a comparable level of industrialization up there, relative to, you know, where we are down here, you're going to have a substantially higher standard of living up there. Just because you have ready access to energy through the sun, you know, you have 24/7 solar, you have ready access to materials in the asteroid belt and various near Earth objects. Shipping costs from station to station are fairly minimal, and as long as you don't go into a gravity well, they're effectively zero. So I think that, you know, the actual benefits of living up there are very, very, very high. You just need to get to a certain level of industrialization before that's actually, you know, achievable and before you actually have a higher standard of living up there.
Okay. Not something I've ever thought about, but describe what your ideal scenario for dwelling in space would be then. Are we talking, you know, trees, large domes full of life? I don't know.
No, you wouldn't want a dome. No.
Or whatever.
No. No, so the way it works is most of the designs have some kind of spin gravity. So you would have basically a torus. You would have something like that spinning around because you want to have 1G gravity. We know 1G works fairly well. We have a lot of data at 1G. We have a little bit of data at 0G. We don't really have much data in between or above 1G. But we know 1G fairly good. We all live at that. We know 0G very, very, very bad for you. And we know more than 1G is also very, very bad for you. Can, you know, puts a lot of stress on your bones, your muscles, your heart, etc. So we want to live at 1G, even when we're in space. So you have this rotating habitat where people actually live and work and do all of that stuff. And then you're going to have certain factories and all of that within 0G. So there are various functions that benefit from 0G, various pharmaceuticals, computer parts, things of that nature that just make more sense to manufacture in 0G. And I'm sure that there are more that we just haven't explored yet. But basically, it's a way of just, you live in basically this torus that's spinning around. You have, you know, basically the same thing you would have down here. You can have trees, you can have plants, you have, you know, your house, maybe some apartments, you have things of that nature, basically.
Personally, how much nature would you need up there?
I like my nature quite a bit, so I would like there to be quite a bit of it.
How big does it have to be then in order for...
Not very big.
No.
Remember, I mean, you have three dimensions.
In order for you... to feel that you're not stuck in a torus or whatever, well, you know, like.
So that's the thing. Basically, again, remember, you're in three dimensions, so you are stuck within a torus, but it feels a lot bigger than it actually is.
Do you know much about seasteading?
Yeah, familiar with it.
No, it just strikes me that there are similarities, obviously. And when I was listening to the seasteaders, I was thinking that all sounds very good, but. I want to go out walking, or I want to, you know, I would do it for one night, like an Airbnb, but I can't imagine my mind would sit very comfortably in something that would feel that isolated. And I'm wondering about space being the same.
It might be. I mean, it's, you know, again, I'm not going to say that I don't really pitch one size fits all, you know, let 1,000 flowers bloom. My main issue with seasteading, and you know, this is basically, again, this would be the thing that would kill off any kind of space habitation, would be there are massive engineering issues with it. But with seasteading itself, you don't get any of the advantages of space from an energy, from a resource point of view, from, you know, a transport cost point of view. So you don't get those advantages. But you also have all of the additional engineering costs that you have up in space. You know, if you're living on a boat, there's a lot of wear that just comes from being out in the sea, being exposed to the salt water all the time. A lot of issues coming just from that. There are also, you know, it's not terribly difficult to access any point on the planet with a boat. So, you know, you still have all of the traditional maritime law issues. You still have, there are basically a million issues with seasteading that I just don't really think are addressed very well. Whereas with space, you know, well, right now it only exists in my mind, so there are no issues with it.
What do you think about, this is very interesting. Is your interest in space got anything to do with the notion of being in a non-sovereign place?
No, I mean, I actually think that living in space from a governance point of view would probably be a lot more authoritarian than down here. If only because there are considerably more environmental concerns up there. So, you know, going back to the whole you live in a tourist thing. Well, what happens if someone throws a baseball too hard and cracks the glass on one end? Well, you really don't want that. You know, that's a pretty severe outcome. So there's probably going to be, you know, a fairly authoritarian government, if only to monitor the environmental situation. Likewise, any pollution. It's a lot more difficult to get rid of it if you're in a Taurus, and it's a lot more difficult for you to deal with it if you're in a Taurus than it is here on Earth. Here on Earth, you know, trees take up a lot of it. Up there, you know, hopefully you have enough trees, but, you know, there's a lot of other, there are a lot of other issues that might come up. So I think that up there it would probably be considerably more authoritarian than I would like, but I think if you get the comparable level of industrialization, I think that you would probably have a higher quality of life up there.
You don't want to live
just from a material point of view.
You don't want to live on the Death Star, though.
No, that doesn't really sound all that nice to me. I'm not really fond of the whole.
Well, I was just thinking. I was thinking it through that Star Wars. When you look at the way people were living in space, the good guys tended to live on planets in the film, didn't they? And the baddies were the ones that were flying around in space. The authoritarians were in space, and the sort of libertarians were down on the forest planet and all that kind of stuff.
The libertarians were the ones, you know, mucking around in the desert and all of that, while the authoritarians were rich and, you know, having parties in space.
Yeah, but they blew up in the end.
Yeah.
Well, great. That's a good way to end. Thanks very much. That was very enlightening. I just learned probably 75% of those concepts I've never heard before. So thanks very much for that. And
well, I got plenty of concepts. I got plenty of books to recommend, too.
Yeah. Well, maybe we'll do a part two at some point. But thanks for that. Very, very appreciate that. Thank you.
Wonderful speaking with you.